Well, we are in the third week of Easter. And traditionally, the church has celebrated Easter not as just one day, but as a season. And I think that's so important for a couple reasons. One, just to remember and reflect that after the resurrection, after that one day, when he walked the earth and who he interacted with, and what was that like? What was the world like when the resurrected Jesus was walking around? And then I think secondly, as important, is just this idea that in light of resurrection, how do we live? Like, does that change the way we make choices? Does that change the way we spend time? Does that change the way we look at what we do and how we create things? And to really be a community that spends significant time being defined by resurrection. And so this morning I want to do that. And I want to talk about something that I think I struggle with, a lot of us in this room probably do. And it's just this idea of tiredness and busyness. So why don't we do this? To get us started, maybe just turn to someone next to you and just share. If there were a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being you feel like full of vitality, like completely refreshed, right? I don't need coffee or caffeine. I'm just naturally full of energy. That'd be 10, okay? Or 0 being I have this crink in my neck, kind of having trouble sleeping. Life is really busy, and I'm tired. So 0 being tired, 10 being full of life, energy, vitality. Just maybe share it with a neighbor, all right? Go ahead and do that. Go. All right. How many do we have above 5? Show of hands, okay? How many do we have below 5? Okay, some of us. I remember this past week, I don't even remember what day it was, and I got home and I'm just kind of feeling tired. And usually I can't nap for more than 10, 15 minutes. And I just laid down. And then 2.5 hours later, like I woke up with like a full beard with hair down on my waist. It felt like that. It was like 8:30. I woke up and had to put the kids down. I was like, what happened, right? And then there's just this sense that a lot of us are just busy and tired. I remember, I don't know if you guys remember, in 1982, ABC broadcasted this one race of the Ironman. And there was this woman by the name of Julie Moss. I don't remember if you guys remember seeing this. She was a senior at Cal Poly, and her major was phys ed. She needed to do a senior project. And so she figures, she discovers this race called the Ironman, which was pretty new at that time. And she goes, oh, this is perfect. It's in Hawaii. It's related to school. Mom will pay for it, and I get to go hang out in Hawaii, right? So she signs up. Mom flies her there. She procrastinates, doesn't really train for it. She figures, like, adrenaline will carry her through. And so an Ironman is you swim 2.4 miles. Just let that sink in a little bit. If you're in a lap pool, do you know how many laps that is? 154 laps, okay? So you start swimming, just sink, you know? Then you bike for 112 miles, and then you do a marathon, okay? That's the Ironman. So she enters this race. She starts swimming, does pretty well. She's on her bike, actually doing pretty well. She says at one point, she's about to take out her last Snickers bar, which has been in her pocket. It was kind of melted. And as she's about to open it and eat it, the ABC news truck comes by, and she thinks to herself, oh, I don't want to look messy on television. So she throws away the Snickers bar. Goes, finishes the bike ride. She's now doing the marathon. She's running it. She's now winning. She comes to 400 yards of the finish line. And then this is what happens. Check out the clip.
While there had been a lead change among the women, 23-year-old Julie Moss, the former college student from Los Ojos, California, had moved ahead of Pat Hines.
Moss came to the Ironman as a college student, just trying to get a degree. No one could have imagined she'd find herself in the lead so late in the race.
Hey, Eva! I know how far back she is.
The she Moss was asking about was Kathleen McCartney, who was in second place in the women's event, nearly 20 minutes behind Julie when the marathon began. As night fell in Kailua Kona, an exhausted Julie Moss was clearly in trouble. Quickly back on her feet, but again her body said no more. Moss would walk methodically down Alihi Drive, now just a few hundred yards from the finish line. Just 30 yards from victory, Moss fights against a body that is shutting down. ABC's cameras captured this drama. As Moss struggled, trying to balance as if on an earthquake, her worst fears were realized as Kathleen McCartney runs past her into first place, just yards from the finish. Unsure of her position and what had happened, McCartney had to be told she'd won by race volunteers at the finish. Moments later, Julie Moss crawled to the finish line in one of the most memorable moments in the history of ABC's Wide World of Sports. Millions of Americans.
And I remember watching this and just thinking about the pace of our lives and the busyness and the running and the striving. And I remember Thomas Merton said this. He said, there's a perversive form of contemporary violence. And he says, and that is activity and work. The rush and the pressure of modern life are a form of perhaps the most common form of its innate violence. And I remember the first time reading that, thinking that's a bit strong, isn't it? But when you see when your body shuts down and you hit this wall where you're overusing your resources, it looks violent. He says, to allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything is to succumb to violence. He says, the frenzy of our activity neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes work fruitful. And I thought it would be, especially in this season of Easter, just to ask, is the pace of our life that we live sustainable? That when we go around, what do we ask? Like, how is everything going? And we're busy and we're tired. And what does it mean then to live life to the fullest? Jesus says, I've come to give you life that's abundant and rich and full. And I don't think he meant that our necks would be tight and we'd have trouble sleeping and we'd have things vibrating in our pockets every few seconds. And to live a life that's sustainable. And so this morning, the lectionary passage in the Psalms, David starts this prayer and he asks God to sustain him. The NIV says, save me, but literally the word there is preserve me, sustain me. And so we're going to walk through this poem together. So if you want to, just read it with a friend. I think we got it on the screen. And then we'll walk through. Psalm chapter 16. Go. All right. So this morning, I just want to ask that if you were to picture your life lived in a way that's abundant and sustainable, What would that look like? What would your days look like? How would you manage your time and your family and your hours? And so let's pick this up in verse 1. He says, keep me safe, and it's literally preserve me. Sustain me through this. And this is the king. I'm sure he had demands and responsibilities. He was busy, and he says, God, sustain me through that. And then he says this phrase, which at first I didn't find very helpful. He goes, for in you I take refuge, right? And so I hear that, and I'm like, okay, that's nice. It sounds nice, but I have no idea what that means. And I don't know if you're like this. Sometimes if I hear cliches, it actually is not only not helpful, it kind of makes things worse for me. A couple months ago, I was having a week that was just really, really tough. I was tired. I was dealing with some really heavy things I needed to make decisions on. I made a couple decisions. I wasn't sure if I made the right decision. And then I remember waking up, and I was really, really tired, really discouraged, just worn out. And then I laid there, just sat there all day, not knowing what to do. And then one of my mentors called me that same day. And then I was like, wow, this is great. Like, somehow he knew. And he's like, hey, I want to take you out for lunch on Wednesday. And so he takes me to this really nice Japanese restaurant. And I was really thankful that, you know, he was caring for me. And then we started talking. And he was really excited about this new project that he was starting up. And I think he wanted to meet to talk about that. And it's pretty exciting and new. But I was so worn out, I didn't really have any capacity to engage. And so I spent about an hour just listening to his new vision. It was pretty awesome. And then when I could finally get a word in, I was just kind of like, hey, you know, kind of having a tough week, and just shared what I was going through. And then he spent the next hour telling me things that I could do better and, like, things that I could be improving on. And I just kind of sat there, like, looking at him, like, wow, this is kind of taking more life away from me. And then spent the next 20 minutes like dropping every like amazing Christian like bomb cliche. And then I think he ended that like lunch with, and the Lord will be your refuge, right? And then I was like, okay. And I just went home. I had to give the car back to Karen, and I was going to come back to Space 12. And Karen could see it on my face. Like, I was pale. Like literally life was drained from me. And she goes, how did lunch go? And I was like, I don't know. And I just laid down and I took a nap. I just like laid on the couch. I didn't know what to do. And I remember this week coming to this phrase, like, I will take refuge. And it made me kind of angry. I was like, I don't know. Like, it sounds nice, but I don't even know what that means. And one commentator says it like this, that maybe another word we could use is recovery. In God, I find where I recover. I go to him to recover, to be replenished. When I go through difficult emotional things that are draining, I need recovery. When there's things that are physically demanding and life changes and we move, have a baby, then you have to recover. And maybe a question is for us to live a life that's sustainable. How do we recover? Where do we go to recover? And how does God offer us recovery? You know, we had babies up this morning. Babies are cute, right? But the whole, like, life of the first year is really intake, right? Mom's milk, which is full of nutrients, right? So they're growing, their brain is developing. Then there's output, they poop, right? And then you got to put them down. They sleep a lot because they're recovering, right? So as a parent, your first 2 years, it's like this ongoing battle of children going, I will never nap, right? To parents going, I love you, please nap. That's pretty much it. That sums up parenting in the first year. I remember there was one time, I think Joshua was around 3. We were out, I don't even remember what we're doing. We're at a park. Some single folks were there. So single folks don't really know what to feed kids. And so I walk over and I see them like giving him this glass bottle. And I was like, oh, cool, right? You know, giving my child's thirsty, giving him something to drink. I get closer, I see there's a glass bottle. The glass bottle has like red letters on it, and the glass bottle says Dr. Pepper, right? So I'm thinking, Joshua's 3. He doesn't drink Dr. Pepper yet. They're like, dude, don't worry. It's Dublin Dr. Pepper, right? It's not corn syrup, right? It's like, don't worry, relax, right? And I was trying to think, okay, I'm not going to be able to explain it to them. Just took my kid away, right? So we went home, it was nap time. We were going to a dinner party that night, and I remember thinking, I'm not sure if he's gonna nap. So we put him in the room, put him down for a nap, and then me and my wife put ourselves down for a nap, right? We woke up 15 minutes later. There's like music blaring in his room. There's like jumping up and down on the bed. And so I open the door, and I see this kid. He's three. His eyes are like this. He didn't have much hair, but imagine like a crazy professor with like hair like flying out. I was like, "Hey, Joshua." He's like, "Hey, Dad," right? I was like, "Did you take a nap yet?" He's like, "No, I don't need a nap," right? I was like, "Well, you should probably lay down. We're going out to a dinner party." He's like, "Okay." So he's trying to like physically lay down, and he can't, like his body won't stop, right? He's like flipping all over the place. So I close the door, and then Karen and I are like, "Okay, he's not going to nap." So we took a video camera, and we put it in the room. I wish I could show you the tape, but it was an actual videotape, and we don't have anything to play it on anymore. But we now have this tape of him. It's about an hour long. At some point, clothes were shed. He's like taking his clothes off, right? We flip like the camera screen so he could see it. So he's like making faces. At some point, he's like checking out his, he only has a diaper on at this point. Do you wear diapers at three? I'm not clear about the age thing. Okay, he had a diaper on. And then he's like backing up and like dancing, like checking out it. So we have like an hour long full of that. And then so finally, you know, we got to go to our dinner party. And I opened the door. I was like, "Hey, did you nap?" He's like, "No, I never need to nap," right? So we get to the dinner party. And as a parent, every parent, you're just hoping to make it through the night at this point, right? So you're like, if nothing's thrown, no blood is shed, it's going to be a great night. So he actually made it through dinner, a little bit too excited about the food, but he ate it. And then it came one point, there was ice cream for dessert. And we're like, "Hey," he liked ice cream. Like, "Hey, Joshua, there's ice cream." And then we're not sure why at that moment, he just breaks down, falls to the ground, and starts weeping. And he goes, "I cannot eat ice cream." And then just starts weeping, and we don't know what to do. So we pick him up. And then he's like weeping, 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 and then just falls asleep. Just runs out of energy, right? And as a parent, you get that because there's physical, like you can see it physically in a child. And then somehow we become adults and we have pills to take, things to drink, things to rationalize. And we don't assume that somehow when there's when we like exhale, when there's something that's given, there needs to be a recovery of it. And the question is, how do we recover? When do we recover? And then you see scripture, there's these beautiful stories, right? Of Jesus saying, "Come to me. If you're weary and burdened, I'll give you rest." There's Elijah who has this huge confrontation with these prophets, and they're like, it's this showdown between Yahweh and their gods. So there's like trash talking, they're like urinating on the fire, and then Elijah wins, right? He wins, and then they still want to kill him, and he's like, "Okay, at this point, if I just did that, I just started a fire, I just took down all the prophets, they still want to kill me," and he said, "I give up. God, I want to die. Just kill me now." And then God engages him, doesn't tell him to do things better, doesn't give him a pep talk. God feeds him, tells him to lie down and take a nap, and then he whispers to him. There's another time Moses has been given this leadership opportunity. He's stuttering. He's like, how can I lead like a million people? I can't even talk. And he's overwhelmed, and he goes to God, and he says, "I don't even know who you want me to lead." And then he asks this. He says, "God, teach me your ways. I want to know how you lead so I can lead these people." And then God's answer to him is, it's not that I will teach you. He says, "My presence will go with you. That's better than me. I'll be with you." And then he says, "My presence will be with you and give you rest." And I think it's amazing that somehow God instituted this in our life. Like from creation, there was the seventh day of recovery and rest. It was holy. It was the first thing that was ever set apart. God's saying this day is going to be really special and you're going to rest. In paradise, we're going to work. In paradise, we're going to create. And then in paradise, we're going to rest. And then when he tells the people, he says, "Remember the Sabbath." Like, we would forget. He's like, you're going to forget one day. So remember, don't forget the Sabbath. Have this rhythm of creation, work, rest. Creation, work, rest. And for us, I'm not going to ask a show of hands. I wonder how many of us practice that rhythm of life. And if we were to practice that rhythm of life, what would sustainability, what would abundance look like? And so David goes, keep me safe, sustain me, for in you, you're my recovery, you're my refuge. All right? Then he keeps going. Verse 2, he says, I say to you, say to the Lord, you are my Lord. Apart from you, I have no good thing. He says, my enjoyment of you is monogamous, he's saying. There's nothing else I enjoy like I enjoy you. Apart from you, I have no good thing. I say to the holy people who are in the land, they are the noble ones in whom is all my delight. So there's this community of people who share in this monogamy of delight of God. Okay? And he says, those who run after other gods, right? Maybe they're short-term gain, but in the end, long-term, they're going to suffer more and more. I will not pour out my libations of blood to such gods or take up their names on lips. And usually at this point, we're like, well, we don't really worship other gods, and right, doesn't really apply. I'm not going to pour out blood offerings. But maybe a question is, why don't we keep the Sabbath? There's usually great reasons, right? I have school, I've got work, I've got kids, I've got soccer. And maybe is our activity in those things, is it a libation being poured out? Or is there an enjoyment that really is monogamous? And then he says this, he uses a food illustration. He says, you alone are my portion and my cup. He's saying, if I had like an Iron Chef competition, right? And there's these great chefs like Thomas Keller, like Gordon Ramsay. I don't know who these people are. I asked Pete and Mel. So I'm assuming you guys do. Thomas Keller. Gordon Ramsay. Yeah? Emeril. Okay, so imagine you got these chefs that are, I guess, well known, and then God's competing, Yahweh is competing. And what David is saying is, no matter how enticing all these other chefs' dishes are, he says, every time I will choose your dish, your portion, your cup. He says, you alone are my portion and my cup. You make my lot secure. And I like the language he uses because there's this enjoyment of God, a delight in God. That's what scripture uses a lot of times. And what Jewish communities and Jewish rabbis say, you know, in the seventh day, when it said that God rested, the word is menuha. And the word is rest, but it's better translated into joyous repose. Delight. This is what one commentator says. To the biblical mind, menuha is the same as happiness and stillness, peace and harmony. It is a state where there's no strife, no fighting, but there's more than that. It wasn't that God just rested and took a nap. Instead, God celebrated and delighted in his creation. God entered the joy of his creation and set it free. And I think we've given Sabbath the short end of a stick. I think we usually talk about it in terms of bottom line, which is the least you can do is stop doing things. But that's the bottom line. And what a lot of Jewish rabbis and writers say is when you stop and rest, then now you recreate the seventh day. You imagine God looks at these mountains and goes, good God, that is amazing. Stands across oceans and says, that's beautiful. Sees roaming buffalo run by and says, you're invited into this. Check this out. This is gorgeous and amazing. And celebrate me, celebrate each other, celebrate creation. And Sabbath is not just rest. It's this invitation into celebrating something that's good and beautiful. This is what Phyllis Tickle says. She says, I never thought of Sabbath as a thing of delight before. I never thought of it as a time for the soul to play and take its leisure. I never thought of it as a time of training to learn to walk again as we once did in familial communion with the Father. It is a transposition of the Sabbath from rule and command observance, listen to this, to a holy romp and a secret playground where every visit adds to another level of delight. And I remember reading that, and the imagery that came to mind. Do you remember, have you guys seen the film Where the Wild Things Are? Right? So Eggers and Spike Jonze recreates this little children's book. And in the movie, in the screenplay, you've got Max, who's this kid. He's growing up in this family that kind of ignores him, right? Mom's got a boyfriend, sister's got friends. And so him and his mom get into it. He runs down to the neighborhood pond where he enters into this fantasy land, right? So he meets these creatures. He meets Carol. He meets these wonderful creatures. And when they first meet him, they have to decide whether to eat him or to make him king. And so in the end, they make him king, and they ask, King, what is your first order of business? Check out the clip.
You are now the king, and you will be a truly great king.
Oh, look, it looks good on him. Look, he looks great, our king!
You look perfect.
King.
It looks perfect,
Carol. Fresh
king.
Fresh king.
I know this part.
King.
Hey, king, what's your first order of business?
We think of Sabbath with that type of joy, with that type of celebration, and what Abraham Joshua Heschel says, that it's the greatest gift that has ever been given to mankind, that we have this rhythm of creation, of making, and then to rest, and then to celebrate, and to enjoy. And God says, don't forget that. Don't forget. And what would our lives look like? What would this community look like? And I have a proposal for us to do this summer, that I think as a church, there's this tendency to do more and more programs, more and more structure. People have needs, and we start more and more things. That's the gravitational pull. And then when I read the text where there's Martha, it seems a lot like Martha. It just seems like we're doing, which is fine, and it's appropriate to do that sometimes. But then Jesus says, there's a hierarchy. That's fine, but there's something better. When Mary just sits at my feet, I enjoy her, and she enjoys me. And so we proposed it to call this summer, There's Something About Mary. But what if we just stopped all of the programs, and then you chose a Sabbath? And I would recommend for your Sabbath to be 24 hours, to end with either liturgy. Some of your schedule, Saturday, which is the actual Sabbath, would work better. And then end your Sabbath with our liturgy together. Some of you, Sunday might work, so you begin your Sabbath with liturgy. And then you spend your week, and life is hard, and there's trouble, and there's misunderstandings, and it's heavy, but there's this one gift that we look forward to week in and week out. And how would our lives be changed? What a gift we could give to the city and the world. And so David goes, there's just one, there's, it's monogamous in my enjoyment of you. Like everyone looks and searches and chases after other gods, but I will only chase after you. Okay. So some of us, and I'm like this too, at this point, we're like, okay, but that feels to me like structure, right? I hate structure. I like freedom, right? I want to determine my own destiny. I will reject all of this. And then David writes this beautiful phrase that I found kind of confusing. He says the boundary lines, so boundaries, I hate boundaries, but he says the boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. So he's not rejecting the boundaries, but he's giving thanks to where the boundaries fall. He says it's pleasant. And surely I will have delightful inheritance. I will praise the Lord who counsels me. Even at night, my heart instructs me. And he talks about these boundaries that are beautiful. And then I thought again, maybe as parents, we kind of get that. I remember when Joshua was young, we literally had a 8-walled octagonal prison that he was in. So it'd be like this playpen you could bring anywhere and had these walls. And then I would come home from work, and then I would see my firstborn son peering over this jail, right? And he'd have this like, save me, help me, I'm in prison, right? And I remember saying to Karen, like, do we really want to raise him in a prison, right? Is that good? And then she was like, you try staying at home all day, yeah? You try chasing him. And I was like, whatever, I could chase him all day. Until one day I had to chase him, and we were at my in-laws' place, and they have this amazing building, which is in Savannah. It's an entire city block, so it's huge. And so most of it is just high, like 20-foot ceilings, hardwood floors. They live in a part of it. They've got some storefronts on the bottom. And then my father-in-law is just fixing up the building as they go along. So Karen and her mom went out to run errands, and then it was me and Joshua. So I was like, oh, we've got freedom, right? This huge building to explore. And so we're wandering around this building. He could barely walk, and he's kind of stumbling all over the place. I remember we were in a part of the building that was really beautiful, and I was just staring at it. And then so captivated, I looked down. I was like, oh, where did my son go, right? And so I was like wandering around, and then I kind of go through a few rooms. Like I was, Joshua, Joshua. And then I turn like 3 more rooms and then make a left. And I see him looking up at me, smiling like he wants me to hold him. But then I notice that there's like antennas sticking out of his mouth. I was like, oh, that's strange, right? So I go over, I pick him up, and then I do the sweep, the mouth sweep. And then out comes not really dead, kind of alive cockroach. And I was like, ah! And then I grab him, and I'm like, we will never tell your mother, ever, right? Deal, make me deal. We will never tell your mom, right? I think I actually told Karen maybe like 7 years later. It took us a while. So you remember that one day? And you have boundaries that are helpful, that are appropriate. And I think when you read in Scripture, David talks about his love for God's laws, his love for the way that God provides, his love for these boundaries. And then Evan and I were actually talking about this one time, and Evan was talking to Corey about it. And it's what they were saying about learning about the importance of boundaries, and what he says was such great commentary on 20-something Austin culture. And it was so good, I made him put it down. And we're going to post it on the website, but let me read a snippet of it. This is what he says. In a closed-circuit traditional society, so a village or a tribe, you're born into a certain role, okay? You don't have as much surface-level freedom of choice, and you have a lot of older people living close to you, peering into your life, influence your decisions according to age-old customs, okay? He says that's village tribal life. He says, but in an open circuit modern society, like Austin, you're born with a blank slate achievement status. You have near complete surface level freedom of choice, and you have the short-term social consequences of negative choices are almost nil because of anonymity. You can do whatever you want. No one will know. And the lack of a real cultural guideline that tries to determine your lifestyle. And then he says, in some ways, open circuit like Austin is good. You have a large opportunity scope. No one's going to stop your dreams. But That assumes a lot of good about the human individual. That we will make the best choices with no advice or constraint and an infinite set of options. He says, right. And it also ignores an even more basic fact of human nature, which is we are creatures of habit. And he talks about we'll still define our own habits just in the ways that we want. But, he says, but the more likely case is we will destroy ourselves by pursuing freedom, both freedom of choice and freedom of advice, until we either kill ourselves or ruin our potential. In many ways, on our own, we're less free than the Afghan villager who was born a goat farmer and will marry whomever his parents picked for him one day. He says that's because although the Afghan farmer will never see a drop of alcohol, will never learn about Charles Bukowski, he knows what it means to be himself. There's no real question what life is about, or how to build a house, or how to raise kids, or how to make a living, or what art means, or what it's for, or what he's going to do with his life. And he says, in his village, which is many ways entirety of the world for him, there is less opportunity, more social responsibility, more cultural restraints, but the upshot is he has a clear sense of purpose, unmuddled by overwhelming options, and he's got people around him to help him in that way. He says, we, on the other hand, we're basically lost. He says, even the best of my friends, the most educated, the most earnest, the most big-hearted, are desperately trying to figure out what the hell to do with the situation we find ourselves in, which is, to make a metaphor, would be a vast landscape with no map. We can go anywhere we want, so we get lost. We make poor choices. We end up in ruts. We lose each other in the darkness, and we sit at our own isolated campfires with nobody, just our own solitary selves for help or company. Then he keeps going, but I'll post it on the website. But the example Evan uses is really interesting. He's like the story of the house built on sand and the house built on rock. So the house built on sand is more free, right? It can be free to move wherever it wants. But the house built on a rock seems less free, but it's more free to be a house that it was designed for. And I think that's just interesting, living in our culture in Austin, in such a hyper-individualistic society where we want no boundaries. And then in this case, God gives us this beautiful, amazing boundary of just week in, week out. Hey, rest and celebrate. Rest and eat dinner with each other. Rest and enjoy me and enjoy each other. And we go, well, thanks, but no thanks. I don't really think I need it. And what would it look like if we became this community that had this rhythm week in, week out, and then maybe 9 months in, 3 months out, where we just sit and enjoy? And I'll just finish with this. Have you guys heard of RAM, the Race Across America? Okay. So it's a bicycle race across 14 states, 3,000 miles in 10 days. Okay? So these guys basically bike without really sleeping. Okay? So they're trying to test their limits. They say usually it comes to Kansas, which is the halfway point, where if physically you haven't broken down, and most of them haven't, the last thing that breaks down is usually your mental capacity. So usually in Kansas, it's just a part of the race. Everyone will start hallucinating, okay? So they haven't slept 4 days. They just start biking. But then these riders use it to their advantage because we have this, like, restrictor physiologically that when we hit the limit sends us pain, okay? But there's a bit of reserve left, but it's trying to shut the body down. It's trying to tell you to stop. Okay, but these riders use it to their advantage. So they see zombies. There's like footage of this guy fighting mailboxes. So this guy who wins it, his name is Yuri. He was in the Slovakian army. So while he's riding, his team drives next to him and plays like Slovakian like war music. And he's riding to it. And then at some point in Kansas, he hallucinates there's Afghan horsemen chasing him. Okay. So the team now uses that to their advantage and goes, you're right, they're coming after you, ride faster. And then they go to see someone who's like at the end of their limit and they're riding for 5 days, they're suffering, and then to tap into that last reserve and like attack 5 days into it, they said it's the most amazing thing you've ever seen. And then in this documentary, The Bicycle Dreams, there's this French biologist, and he just wanted to test his limits. So somewhere around Kansas, he's really suffering. He hasn't spoken for days. The crew pulls up next to him and then asks him, why are you doing this? Why are you riding? He doesn't answer. He keeps riding. A couple days pass. He just keeps plugging into it. Rides, rides, rides. Some of these riders, their neck gives way. So they duct tape it back so they can see when they're riding. I kid you not. So at this point, this guy hasn't said anything, hasn't spoken. And then he says he hits this point where he says everything became silent. And he reached this place of like serenity. He said it was really, really beautiful and quiet. And then he heard this voice in his head. And the voice said, stop. And he heard that voice. He stopped, got off his bike. Then he walked away. And then Radiolab did a piece on these two riders. And they're like, we don't know who to be more impressed with. They're like, that first guy is impressive, but kind of in a crazy way. But the second guy, to hear that voice and have the courage to respond to that is amazing. And I pray that our community will live slow enough, will live in a pace that's sustainable enough, with these amazing, beautiful boundaries God has given to us, and live life to the fullest. Let me pray for us.